interrupting the current neo-eucronial, climate-challenged, behaviorally controlled, energy-starved, alien-invaded, nuclear-glowing, postulated cricketism to bring you behind the woodshed. This is Cricketude Busting Episode BTWRLM 588. And remember, being free is not a spectator sport, because you don't know what you missed until you get behind the woodshed. And that requires a vigilance and diligence and hard work, and I guess I got something to clear up for y'all. I apologize for the last couple of weeks not getting on quite so well at all on the player on Sunday. But we've had a problem come up, and it's the RLM administrator is missing in action right now, and we can't find where he's gone. And so there's been a problem in doing our administration. So I guess I need to say a couple things here on that. I'm hoping whatever's happened, it clears itself up. There's nobody that knows him that has figured out where he's gone. In the meantime, until we can't get access now because it's such a security breach at RLM before it changed over, we fixed a lot of that all up so that we wouldn't have those security breaches, and they all stopped. The problem is we're so secure now, not anybody can get into the site, and there was no copies made of the information. They're not lost. They're just not in two places at once. So there's no thing that we know to do at this point that I know of. There's nothing that I know to do to fix this at some level, except for a slight workaround that on Sundays, if you'll come every Sunday, I'll attempt to get at least the broadcaster posted so you can go to reallibertymedia.com and see the most latest and recent posting, which would be the Sunday broadcast. You just won't find it at the player playing live. So we'll get it a different way. And if you go to rlmradio.xyz, and if you look in the window in the middle of the page, the player will be playing whatever it's going to be playing. Again, as long as everything holds together, this will be normal up until something breaks. But if you go in the middle of the page, you'll find a recents, and you should look for this match the date for the Sunday. And if you see the date for the Sunday for the broadcaster, click that, and you'll find the player in the broadcaster, and you have all the links there, too. The only other places you can find Behind the Woodshed is at BitChute. I do a posting at Mines, but that goes to BitChute as well. So those of you at Mines can go there. I don't get a lot of action over at Mines at all. So those of you that go there, I appreciate it. I appreciate any kind of spreading of the word. I appreciate it and getting the word out. There's not many people apparently that are interested, but those that I talk with and I work with, we all know that what I'm doing is important. So I've attempted to make that normal in all the chaos in my life. To hold it out and continue to do this, keep one thing in my life normal if everything else is blowing up in my face and complete abuse and hardship, then this comes along and it makes it a lot more difficult. So barring a problem with RLM and barring a problem with my connectivity to the network, I'll attempt to get the broadcaster up every week until we can figure out what's gone on. And I just don't have an answer to all this, and we'll just have to see. So anybody who might know who the administrator is and where he might be, if you could please give me word. I don't understand what's going on. I last was in conversation to him, and the next day there was no communication at all, and it's been a couple weeks now. So I guess that's enough of that. If you would kindly stick with the broadcast to find it where it is, as long as we get RLM, it'll be there. It'll be at BitChute as long as I can get to the Internet. If I can't get connectivity to the Internet, I'm done anyway, so. That's always been a problem. A couple people have stepped up to continue my ability to make connection. And so that's how you've even been hearing me at all. Otherwise, what I'm suffering here, the abuse I'm suffering and can't escape it, is total at this point. So back to the broadcast. If you would, I'll try to do that on Twitter. I'll try to tell where the broadcast is and just remind you it's at RLM, reallibertymedia.com at the broadcaster. Or it'll be at BitChute. So appreciate your patience and your tolerance of the problem. I don't know what more to say. But to getting on to this broadcast, and kind of interesting, I think I've been pretty good talking and coming up with these pieces of information as we've been talking and bringing it along, trying to keep our heads straightened up on all of this stuff we see anymore, because, as I said, we're going into the age, years ago I said this, we're going into the age and era of deception. And to be able to look through the deception is going to be a key skill that you'll have to build. And part of that is just being well read. And I don't mean about a bunch of junk, a bunch of stuff. I mean, read what the conditions are and be able to get through that pretty quickly. It's a lot of work. It's a pretty steep climb to get through the basic stuff that you might need to know, but once you get it under your belt, the observations come pretty quickly, and we can cut through things. So that's what we have to do. Then we have the system that's gone nuts, and I dare say unplanned, and I don't see a difference in it's a continuation of what happened. Again, I mentioned the Lincolnization of America, and then it went from that and transitioned into the War of Terror, and this is the kind of thing we have, and over 20-something years we've been living underneath that. That seems to have gone away. The people don't realize it's still running, that condition. We just see it's gone nuts. And then we had the fraud of the economic system, which was another notice to us to say, this thing, here's your notice that you don't want to be here. I don't mean here physically. I mean in those things, those products that the government offers to us. In the meantime, I was telling you about mining law and that the states have these obligations to do. And they're sitting there as obligations, not as clubs to beat things down, but literally as protections. And we hear a little bit of that in those states' police powers that we were talking about. I was showing you and explaining to you in the Covey swindle, the great Covey swindle. They were going to use that. I told you that before it even started. They figured that out in us. We saw that at 9-1-1. That's where you got your first inkling about how they were going to come down on us and how they were going to try and skirt all of law by doing that. And the police powers sit there as these obligations, but not in a sense of protecting, as we might think, like outbreaks and this and that, but as protecting the state itself and getting it back to the organic level of the people within the state who purportedly have created the state itself. And so this comes up in another, we've been hearing this story come along, and this is going to be an ongoing story, but it's, as I was telling you about the mining law, we found where state's attorney generals are very powerful, especially when they get on point and they get into this constitutional and if it's an argument, present the constitutional position as an obligation that they need to protect. And that will likely prevail against the federal government. Usually that's not contrary to the intention of Congress, no matter what the subject matter is. And this, I think this next case here that's been found in favor of the state is one of those things. Texas gets wind from full appeals court in dispute with DOJ over buoys in Rio Grande. As I'll interject here quickly and then can get back to reading. Remember, this is a borderline, not just an international borderline, but this is the borderline discussion, and we got that dual construction in the United States of America, federal and state, and whose authorities run and prevail against another, or are they even not relevant? And this is where this case starts to come onto, where Texas put those buoys becomes interesting. I'll tell you, find out where you are, find out where the authority claims to be, claims to want to be, and then see if it's proper there. And this court's coming back as one option of the problem to say the federal government has no authority here in this part of the river, and so, or on this part of the land border. So listen for these things. And I say listen to them because these land laws are how you start to define yourself and your land law, your land protection, even within a state. And so, again, I take notice from these things to see, well, guide what I've been studied and researched and found and tried to figure out and then apply. And then, is that what's going on in the world? Is that really what's happening out there as we see these cases come forward on these attorneys that they're supposed to be protecting the people, not using them as a revenue enhancement tool or for other control. But here, the full U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals handed Texas a major win Tuesday in its ongoing legal dispute with the Biden administration over the state's construction of the floating barrier in the Rio Grande. Circuit Judge Don Willett, writing for the majority of the New Orleans-based court, said the relevant federal laws likely did not apply to the stretch of the river where the Texas had placed the buoys. He also concluded that the Justice Department had, quote, offered no evidence that the barrier threatens safety, and rejected the department's arguments that the lower court order was necessary to alleviate diplomatic tensions with Mexico. So understand these positions here. I can just see property law coming right up to discuss it. And you notice that the federal court and the governments go right to their police powers, which would be safety. And the court said, well, there was no evidence brought forth. I don't want to go back over to the Greg Kobe swindle, but isn't that the identical thing? I said you have to have a non-fraudulent demonstrable exigence of the need. And if you don't, you don't have authority here. And that's just what this appellate court is saying at this point. Circuit Judge James Ho, known for his especially strident opinions, wrote a partial dissent that said Texas should prevail for a different reason. Its move to erect the buoys is a strategic military decision by the state to repel a foreign invasion, making the case a political dispute that courts lacked the authority to weigh in on. That's a jurisdictional statement right there. They don't have jurisdiction to look at these political aspects. And so, again, there's a lot to learn as we see these courts, instead of trying to make it all up like we think we know better, watch how the courts treat this. And I'm saying it like this because when you go read law about property and borders and states and their authorities and where they can and can't, this seems right on track. He brings up independently a military need to stop an invasion, which is an underlying right of the state. And I suspect this case is being set up in case they appeal. So this is added by this judge, astutely added by the judge, to give the Attorney General of Texas an added piece of information that he can add in the appeal. The Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott celebrated the ruling on X with a post saying, quote, Texas can keep these buoys in the water, securing our borders. And the proceedings will continue in the case as it heads to full trial. And so this was an injunction by the federal government to cease the stay that was put on the federal government wanting those things removed. And the court came back and said, no, you can't. This is a border protection issue, an invasion protection issue. The federal government didn't bring anything to stop that prerequisite of power and authority and duty of the state itself. Another case here on the border. What happens at the borders, you may not think about it too much when you're traveling. If you're traveling international, in these international airports, they're ports, the commerce ports, ports of call, wherever they is inside the country. Courts close the loophole, letting the feds search your phone at the border. This is a really big deal. And there's a little nuances all this time. I've been reporting on these things as we've been going through the years. And little decisions will be made here and there to plug the holes. And this is one of the big ones, one of the last ones. A judge finally picked it up and went for it. The Fourth Amendment still applies at the border, despite the Fed's insistence that it doesn't. For years, courts have ruled that the government has the right to conduct routine, warrantless searches for contraband at the border. Customs and Border Protection has taken advantage of the loophole in the Fourth Amendment's protection against unreasonable searches and seizures to force travelers to hand over data from their phones and laptops. But on Wednesday, Judge Nina Morrison in the Eastern District of New York ruled that the cell phone searches are a non-routine search, more akin to a strip search than scanning a suitcase or passing a traveler through a metal detector. Let me interject here because this doesn't even touch it. Remember all those millimeter wave scanners they put in. Think about that and applied there. Going over to here. Although the interests of stopping contraband are, quote, undoubtedly served when the government searches the luggage and pockets of persons crossing the border carrying objects that can only be introduced to this country by being physically moved across its border, the extent to which these interests are served when the government searches data stored on a person's cell phone is far less clear, the judge declared. Morrison noticed that, quote, reviewing the information in a person's cell phone is the best approximation government officials have for mind reading. So searching through a cell phone data has an even heavier price impact than rummaging through physical possessions. Therefore, the court ruled a cell phone search at the border requires both probable cause and a warrant. Morrison did not distinguish between scanning a phone's contents with special software and manually flipping through it. And in a victory for journalists, the judge specifically acknowledged the First Amendment implications of cell phone searches too. She cited reporting by The Intercept and Vice about CPB searching journalists' cell phones, quote, based on these journalists' ongoing coverage of politically sensitive issues, close quote, and warned that those phone searches could put confidential sources at risk. Wednesday's ruling applies to a stream of cases restricting the Fed's access to search travelers' electronics. the Fourth and Ninth Circuits, which cover the Mid-Atlantic and Western states, have ruled that the border police need at least reasonable suspicion of a crime to search cell phones. Last year, a judge in Southern District of New York also ruled that the government, quote, may not copy and search an American citizen's cell phone at the border without a warrant, absent exigent circumstances. There it is. Non-fraudulent exigent circumstance. This is the police power. There it is again. This is not just words and things I make up and said all these years. Here's the standard being restated again and again. And we should be looking as the people say, why is it again and again? Why was it the first time? First of all, why didn't they just stay away from the violation? Why did they go into the second when they were told no? Is our problem. The Knight First Amendment Institute of Columbia University and the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press filed an amicus brief, friend of the court, amicus's friend, friend of the court brief, just advises the court what it's found, its findings are. They did that in October 2023, arguing that warrantless phone searches are, quote, a grave threat to Fourth Amendment right privacy as well as the First Amendment freedoms of speech, the press, and association. Morrison heavily cited the brief in her ruling. And remember, when I've talked about this, we always have this right of association to be able to interact in order to be able to speak. And so they've added it right here. Not many times you see that association added, but here it is in this case. As the court recognized, letting border agents freely rifle through journalists' work product and communications whenever they cross the border pose an intolerable risk to press freedom, close quote. Grayson Clary, staff attorney for the Reporters Committee of Freedom of the Press, said in a statement sent to reporters, quote, this thorough opinion provides powerful guidance for other courts grappling with this issue and makes clear that the Constitution would require a warrant before searching a reporter's electronic devices. Now, the caveat to that is we know that FICA, if they invoke that, it's just like a rubber stamp. And we also know that judges may or may not, most of the time it's may not, be too restrictive on that government access. It takes seemingly very little to get these warrants anymore either. However, we do have at least a procedural check now in place that at least the court has now brought up. If they want to challenge this thing goes to the Supreme Court. And I think with the strict scrutiny type view that this current court has taken, the Supreme Court, these things should stand. I can't make that prediction. It looks like the way the courts have been wording their things, I guess I'm a bit encouraged that we're finally, all these years later, getting to the point when we're now finding out 20, 30 years after, 40 years, 50 years, 70 years later, oh, all that was illegal that the government has done to us. And we, as a people, just sit here and take that. But I can't quite get it. But also include a link to the EFF 2023 report on this. It says federal judge makes a history of in holding the border searches of cell phones require a warrant, where you can find many court case links in support of referencing the Smith case from that Sultanoff case I just mentioned. And it might be a good idea there here, since it's all in one spot, on the, even though it says 2023, to brush up on these cases. They're all together. Read through them. Start understanding what this territory, this ground is that they're talking about, so that you understand when you go into these places, as I said, you question authority the proper way. It's not just because some constitution said so. It's because because that's not good enough anymore, you see. You have to have these judges making the decision, and there has to be a thorough recital from some of this. And the Supreme Court ultimately has to weigh in, otherwise you see, it doesn't really matter. And so we now have these cases coming. If you look at these Supreme Court cases relative to this matter, you might be able to find a quick and narrow path, and I've understood a couple people have used my material, as I said, how you approach this, and been able to get through custody. I clearly say your mileage will vary because it all depends on what you've learned, how much you've accepted is what's there, and not imposed yourself into it, and taken what it is, and then be able to recite the proper, the simple proper things back. You don't become an encyclopedia. The encyclopedia sits in you. You only put out what you need to tell them. And you know you can back that up with that black and white, as I keep telling you. The same thing this court does, the same thing this judge just did, recites these statements. So these cases would be a good place to go if you're interested in this. I think it's important. I think where they're taking us is important. It all started with this 9/11 nonsense. And so this is where we go. And this routine warrantless search nonsense kicked into the high gear with the gift that keeps on giving, terror, as we now see this week, finally, how many years? What an embarrassment. What barbaric system that we have. 9/11 suspects to plead guilty. The controversial deal will spare the lives of Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and his henchmen. And boy, they get a lot of mileage out of this, too. The alleged, listen carefully here. Listen carefully. Listen to the hesitation, the failure to actually prove it beyond a reasonable doubt what happened. And understand what these guys did, went through to come to the day that they just said, okay, I'll plea out. And don't underestimate what we're talking here is a bit what Julian Assange went through to finally say, okay, I'll take your charges. I just want to get on. I'm not going to be hurt so bad, and it's time to move on. Years and years and years later. The alleged mastermind of a 9/11 terrorist attacks and two of his accomplices have agreed to plead guilty in order to avoid the death penalty. American prosecutors revealed in a letter on Wednesday, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and Walid Mohammed Saleh, Mubarak bin Attash, and Mustafa Ahmed Adam al-Hawasi have agreed to plead guilty to all of the charges offenses, including the murder of 2,976 people, close quote. Military prosecutors wrote in a letter, which was sent to family members of the victims. In exchange for the pleas, the three terror suspects will receive life sentences, avoiding a major trial and a possible death sentence at the U.S. Navy's detention facility in Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Mohammed is widely regarded as the mastermind of the 2001 attacks, which were the deadliest assault on the U.S. in the nation's history. And they seem to want to push and push and poke and prod, and I told you they're going to bring this back. Well, they waited all this time to bring it back right now. And so they must have done it, right? They must have done it because they said they pled guilty. Let's find the punchline incriminating this American just us system, just as we saw working for Julian Assange. All three were captured in 2003 and spent time in secret CIA prisons before ending up in Guantanamo Bay, where they have been held without trial ever since. All three, you had a right to speedy trial, folks. See, the Supreme Court has said everybody seems to have all these rights that we're supposed to have. As everybody who gets involved with this American judicial system, supposed to have all the rights that everyone else has. However, this is where we start getting into what the Turners did in changing these little definitions and statuses. Remember, we ended up getting indefinite detention and Obama killing American citizens with this stuff. All three were subjected to brutal torture techniques, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and sodomy, according to a 2014 U.S. Senate report and leaked diplomatic cables. Can I say that again? The year 2014, they have been suffering these things since then. Pick up sodomy. That's interesting. It makes the news this week. News of the plea deal angered organizations representing the families of the 9/11 victims who want the suspects held for further questioning. Think of that. But being subjected to brutal torture techniques, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and sodomy, isn't enough for these families. They want more for money. Quote, we urge the administration to ensure that these deals do not close the door on obtaining critical information that can shed light on the Saudi Arabia's role in the 9/11 attacks. Our quest for justice will not waver until the truth is revealed. No, the U.S. government nor anyone else had anything to do with 9/11, did they? So why would the U.S. not want the truth revealed in making the deal that might foreclose that possibility? And if you have the need, I have a bridge to sell you. Why wouldn't they want this information coming up? Why wouldn't they want someone to extract what the truth was? And the families are outraged and don't want the ability to not have that, because they want money from the Saudis. But the government has its own national security interest, doesn't it? So, being subjected to brutal torture techniques, including waterboarding, sleep deprivation, and sodomy, probably does something to you, I would suspect. Maybe that's the reason for the plea. Sodomy alone isn't inhumane enough to invalidate justice being able to be rendered in this. That was the delay they're claiming, that all these, if this information was gotten due to these things. But this is not a question, apparently, in these LGBTQ it-controlled America. Because it's happened. It's allowed. Well, I can just imagine, well, we'll stop all this if you just plead guilty. Well, you'll go to a normal prison, and you won't suffer all this torture. Which they likely were facing a death penalty anyway. And these lawful treatments has spread here to these supremely chosen psychopaths. Again, this week coming up. Who these folks really are. Israeli lawmakers defend alleged rape of Hamas prisoner as far-right protesters rage over IDF troops' detention. If the world isn't evil enough, isn't showing you enough, we get to hear of this. As disgusting as this stuff is, I didn't even want to bring this, talk about these things. But I think it's giving us an insight that needs to be at least thought about what these entities called governments do and allow themselves to do. You saw that, you heard the very same thing happening in Guantanamo. Here it's in Israel. These are the chosen. Ultra-right wing Israel nationalists stormed two military facilities late Monday, protesting the detention and questioning of nine Israeli Defense Forces reservists suspected of raping and abusing a Palestinian prisoner whose injuries were so bad he had to be hospitalized. The social media videos show the guards at the Sidi Timan military base and a prisoner near Beersheba in southern Israel shouting at a military police and pushing them when they had arrived to question the reservists, seemingly in defense of the suspects. Seemingly? Seems more than seemingly if we read on. On Monday evening, a group of Israelis attempted to storm another military facility with one protester threatening an uprising against the government if the suspects remain in custody. These people are protesting that people who raped other prisoners, the Israeli soldiers who raped prisoners, need to be released. This is their society now coming to agree with that. A member of the Prime Minister Netanyahu's Likud party speaking Monday at a meeting of lawmakers justified the rape and abuse of Palestinian prisoners, shouting angrily at colleagues, questioning the alleged behavior that anything was legitimate to do to terrorists in custody. Lawmaker Hanok Milwitzki was asked, as he defended the alleged abuse, whether it was legitimate to insert a stick into a person's rectum. His answer, yes, he shouted in reply to his fellow parliamentarian. If he is a Nakba, Hamas militant, everything is legitimate to do. Everything. So you heard that right. Everything. A society that believes rape and everything, other barbaric things, is legitimate acts of the military. Oh, but if it happens to one of them, oh, how they would wail humanitarian crimes, anti-Semitism, Holocaust. I actually can't believe I'm reading some of this stuff. But here we are. Here's the day we're in this day. They're actually protecting this behavior. It's not just them. It's the United States was doing it. Which came first, the chicken or the egg? Yeah, but heck, if it's good for the puppet called the United States, it's good for the puppet master holding the stick supporting the puppet, right? But remember, and never forget, the Zionist military and state of Israel is an illegal occupier having no right of self-defense. I've gone through this. The Palestinians here of which now suffering rape in the streets now. After this decision, the military went onto the streets. We started seeing video returns of that. They're now demanding it in the streets. The Palestinians are not terrorists. And they have a right of resistance under international law, as I've read to you in many Behind the Woodshed episodes long ago. And confirmed here also, these statements were confirmed what I read a couple weeks ago, by the findings by that ICJ restating that law and more in its condemnation of the illegally occupying Zionist Federation. So, again, it's there to read, it's there to see. This is not even a question. That it's not a question and we see support is really an abomination. It's beyond, it's evil. And no, Satan Yehu who is being identified for being irreligious as well here. We all think it's the Jews, it was about religion. No. Is it a religious state? No. He's irreligious. He's part of a long family history. I think it was over 100 years I was reading, of supporting this Zionist Federation political movement. So we shouldn't expect morality from them, nor the compromised puppets in the U.S. Knesset either, Congress, excuse me, sitting on that stick. Now, this is a rabid group of animals in the world. I don't know what else to say about it. How anyone can support this is beyond my comprehension, actually. I just don't understand. I just can't get it. And we say everything. He says everything is available to do to people. I'll read an article. The Heart of Darkness is a rebellion brewing in the Zionist torture dungeons. Recent events have shown us beyond any doubt the rotten heart that beats inside the chest of a Zionist movement. Far-right Zionists are now besieging their own military bases, the infamous Sadeh Tamen prison, in defense of 9 convicted rapists. As much as that sounds like hyperbola designed to discredit the Zionist regime, it is not. And as is usual, the Zionists are going out of their way to discredit themselves. Sadeh Tamen is one of the most notorious torture dungeons operating by the Zionist entity. It is often compared to the diabolical black sites operated by the Obama-Biden regime around the world, where dissidents are kidnapped, held indefinitely without charge or trial, and tortured. However, in reality, it may be even worse. The New York Times, CNN, and Washington Post investigated prisons months earlier and found indisputable evidence of widespread torture, including mauling prisoners with dogs, widespread and weaponized rape, routine electrocution, and keeping prisoners in extreme temperatures. Testimony revealed that prisoners were even raped to death, sodomized with hot irons, until they bled out. Even the propagandists who spent decades defending the CIA's program of extraordinary rendition were appalled by what the Zionists had done. Despite this and other investigations showing that torture, murder, and rape were widespread and accepted in Zionist prisons, the Zionist entity did not act until the 29th of July, after a Palestinian prisoner was found with a severe rectal damage that he could no longer walk. Military police moved to investigate Sadeh Tamen. What they found was shocking, even for them. At least 9 of the guards were torturing prisoners not for intel or because that they were ordered to, but simply for fun. The pictures and videos were posted on social media, giving so much evidence that not even the Zionist regime could ignore it. The military police raided the prison and arrested the 9 reservists who they blamed for the abuses. While they are certainly torturers, these men are only scapegoats who were following the orders of their superiors. In keeping with the model of their NATO allies, the Zionists will pin the schemes on their general staff and a handful of conscripts, then wash their hands of the matter, pretending justice has been done after they sweep the crimes under the rug. In fact, I heard, if it's correct, most of those were released. Those prisoners convicted of this were released back into the system, back into the military, back into society. So, remember this, though. Claiming the right to gang rape the Palestinians is being declared by the most moral army in the world. Get that. They're claiming a right to gang rape people because they're the most moral army in the world. And the United States compromised Congress creatures are already up with that. They're cool. And so this next reports on these that I'm going to read about and other international law violations by the Zionist occupying regime should be more troubling, as Satan Yehu brings American soldiers more into harm's way by the U.S. Knesset regime puppet riding the broom handle they love so much for pleasure and profit. As we read, what's going on here? This week is really starting to escalate. I'll just interject a bit here. Remember what I said about what they needed out of the assassination attempt of Trump and what's happening very quickly now hereafter. Iran's Khomeini vows harsh punishment for Israel after Haneyeh killing. And if you're not, I've been telling you to be paying attention to who the people are that are being killed, assassinated, where they're at, more as importantly, what they're doing, even more importantly, relative to that belligerent occupier law that I read to you. And start keeping track of all these details, because this is where you start to understand the depth of the abomination going on, the audacity, or worse, that's going on, the evil that is inside these people that are running around wanting to see a bigger war. They're not going to fight it. Your sons and daughters are. Supreme Leader says avenging Hanaya's assassination in Tehran is Tehran's duty as Iran announces 3 days of mourning. The criminal and terrorist Zionist regime martyred our dear guest in our house and made us bereaved. Khamenei said in a statement on Wednesday, adding that it also prepared the ground for a harsh punishment for itself. He said it was Iran's duty to avenge the assassination of Khamenei, who was in the Iranian capital for the inauguration of President Masoud Pezeshkian. Not here, just as a thought here, moreover here on this, Iran, which like Russia in Ukraine, by Western lawless compulsion, may become a ring in Iran's nose if it's not careful here. It has a right to retaliate pursuant to Iran's right to self-defense outlined in Article 51 of the Charter of the United Nations. And that was just confirmed by the United Nations Secretary General. So I want you to pay attention. It appears that Iran and Russia and all these countries are using the international law in strict scrutiny and strict application. The United States and Israel is not. And I think that'll play better for them as we run this thing along, and I think it has. But as an aside here, as evidence of properly removing that intended ring in Russia's nose, it is reported that Zelensky has agreed to enter peace negotiations with the Kremlin after the autumn counteroffensive, which will be Ukraine's final push in that war. As I told you then, Russia's being pushed into a corner. They are led by the nose by the actions the West has taken. They have to respond. Same thing here. This is the same danger that Iran is facing. And it is subsequently being reported now in the assassination of a Hamas leader, all happening within days, if not hours, in Iran, this gentleman. And notice that the notice to all of us here that Ismail Haniyeh's cell phone is said to have been infected by an NSO group, Pegasus spyware, via WhatsApp, that's owned by Mark Zuckerberg and Meta. And so that's one of the reports coming. They're still actually studying it. The most recent investigation says it was actually an air dropped missile of some sort or bomb. And that brings up a whole other embarrassment for Iran. How did an air drop device get into their border without being stopped? But they were saying based on this, it was used to identify his location and the presence where it is said a bomb had been planted as well, another story, in the place months before. And I'll be talking here in a moment, another tab, another piece of information that pops up. How can this all be happening? And you know, we'll see how infiltrated these countries really are. Every country has these problems relative to intelligence agencies inside their borders. In America, it seems that we don't think that that's going on, or that maybe the CIA and the FBI isn't one of those intelligence agencies against us either. However, different thought about that. So with that regard, and with the insult, with the invasion, it's not only about security and sovereignty and embarrassment to Iran. It is a matter of honor for Iran to respond. And remember, the ICJ also made comment that all the nations are supposed to be stopping what they're seeing that's happening in Palestine, in Gaza, with what the Zionist regime is doing. All nations, and even NGOs, even non-governmental organizations, are all supposed to be trying to stop that. That's a duty. So it's an honor here for Iran to respond. And yes, we in America may no longer recognize honor, but honor is still a very big thing in the Middle East. And we can listen for this as we move along. And we'll listen to that also in Russia's words as well, honor to itself and its history. And so these are very deep-seated things that they're not persuaded by an angry look or a threat. And this is what I kept telling you about Russia as well. So the game is similar, not the same, but similar between this and getting Iran moved into a position where, again, the United States has been wanting to get Iran, and this is where it's coming. And this is not really maybe necessarily something the United States actually needs, except through Israel. And so this is another angle going on. But getting to this point where honor is being raised up and they're fighting, and we saw what Yemen did. It's all the same. That's what you watch. They don't care what anybody thinks about them. They're going to do honor, or what they think is honor, and they're going to fight, and it doesn't matter what comes against them. And I don't think that the West appreciates that. I don't think that. I think that because maybe we don't, in the West, we don't honor honor. We're not honorable. So we're in a real dangerous territory if a more moderate condition, less than full-on war, was more desirable. We're kind of stepping beyond that. But full-on war is what the falsified victimhood Zionist movement barbarian intends in their quest for a greater Middle East illegal occupation, it seems, as we watch this thing expanding out. But it is a fraudulent intention when we also do the study in the historic reference and context. But apparently no one else seems to notice this. And I say that as well, so much so here that I mentioned here that the ICJ reminded them of their obligations and duty to stop the genocide of all those countries and all those non-governmental organizations. And they watch this thing continue as they sit on their hands on top of it. So we see lots of talking and no actual action, but it's coming to those nations. Now Iran's right on the hit list of it. And to the ends of the continuing genocide and expanding war, nevertheless, and the counter to United States obligations and duties with others that I've just mentioned in part, this thing continues. And this is the thing I found the importance of the ICJ discussion. Not that it had any teeth to do anything, not enforcement power. It was a simple reminder what the black and white that all these nations agreed to participate with, they were derelicted. It's being reported the United States puppet is sending warships now on top of it, which are said to contain expeditionary forces of the United States military, notwithstanding the obligation to stop that what's going on. So this means boots on the ground. Those of you in the United States of America, your sons and daughters, wives and husbands, sisters and brothers, or grandchildren are going to die for fraud to the great profit of the compromised and connected Congress critters, the military and banking investment complexes. As we move this forward, you are fodder, not them. This is where this gets pushed. Iran's powerful Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps said the attack showed that the Zionist gang of criminals, murderers, and terrorists had no regard for international rules. Can we confirm that the statement that they are barbarians acting contrary to international law? Iran sees it. Iran just said it. Can we say that these folks are acting contrary to international law? They don't care about international law. The point is, it doesn't matter if a criminal doesn't care about the law. The offensive acts must be stopped. I've read through this, what these standards were, when I read the proof through the international law of war for belligerent occupations. And in this case, go back and look. Didn't say it on purpose. I said, got to go back and see who these people are. This Hamas representative was a political leader. And by that belligerent occupations law of war, that leader is off limits to any occupying force. Remember, I mentioned the political side of this group is not supposed to be touched. Notwithstanding, this guy was the head negotiator. How are you going to go through and expect a negotiation when you kill the negotiator? There's another interesting problem. But this also shows the plan working out that they don't want a negotiation. Satan Yehu does not want a negotiation, if there needs to be one. This should actually be straightened out the way it was originally set up. There is no two-state solution. It was set up as one state assimilating those that wanted to come. That's how it was set up, but that was just a ruse. So this is all in disregard of the violation to a country invaded for such a killing, an assassinated party here, which had just paid respects to the new political leader there. That's what the big insult as a guest he was. The new president here of Iran was receiving him. It was invited by them. And this guy was tracked back after that meeting. And all these political actions are off limits to a belligerent occupier. That's if the occupier had a right, which the governing Zionist regime over Palestine does not, pursuant to international law. This is not my opinion. This is strictly the black and white, the international norm of how you deal in these things. And there's good reason for why they deal with these things in these ways. So in this case, the IRCG is correct in its assessment. What is also then absurd is that the United States has declared Hamas a terrorist group, which included Haniyeh, proving the U.S. is not interested in comporting its actions to international law or norms either. Again, as a political creature, Haniyeh was off limits under international law. Now, I suppose it could be said the United States Zionist organized crime syndicate, but birds of a feather commit genocide together relative to this issue coming up. And I just can't tell you how serious this thing is. And it's being stepped along. There's a purpose. It's not hidden, but it's not being spoken of. And then there's this contention. Remember we talked about there was Pegasus spyware and all that and everything. Someone writes an interesting observation. I wanted to include this observation to sort of expand on how we would look at approach. I don't necessarily agree with all this. Accidents happen. But he makes a good point. His contention relative to the spyware and who done it is more of a cynical view here, but I don't think it's necessarily untrue either. That what we're being told is, again, information warfare. And we get a bunch of things coming out at us, and we try to figure out, orient ourselves with it, and try to make sense. Well, it's almost impossible, and we're not there. And this is how this game is played, if you will. Why I say you got to look through the deceptions, look through the noise, filter it out. And this view is interesting. And like I said, there's some logical missteps, but he makes an important point. If we look at all these things and we just take it on face value that it was Pegasus software, we're missing a bigger point. We should be finding ourselves to be submissive to any suggestion. And so I use that and say, yeah, we don't want to be that. So let's look at this, let's qualify it, and then we can move through it. Tehran turned out to be full of CIA agents. Now, understand the scope of this discussion from there, looking at this, but now let's, in your mind, as we're reading through this a bit, apply it around the world. Apply it here in the States. Apply it to a very recent action against a candidate. And consider. Just consider. Again, potentials and possibilities. I don't know that we know quite enough in all of this to really make a set and certain discussion. What I've said is you take your best assessment and you use that, you find the worst case scenario and work from there. And any lesser scenario you've got handled, at least psychologically, at least by thought, at least by response. You're already 2, 3, 5, 10 steps, even practiced, experienced in running the worst case scenario. Anything less will be easier to handle. In the heart of Iran, the capital of the country, the head of Hamas Politburo, Ismail Haniyeh, was killed. The United States blames everything on Israel's actions, but the Iranian mission to the U.S. stressed that such an audacious crime would have been impossible without the support of the CIA. I need to interject now because I don't know if I get to it, but we're going to talk about it. Prisoners were released. The CIA was intimately involved in that. So the CIA has got a couple of threads going through this week's news as well, but out in public now. So this writer says this would have been impossible without CIA interference or help. And then he makes an interesting observation near the end of who didn't talk and who did. And he said that points to who's behind the scenes working this. And it's all plausible. Whether or not it's all exactly truth, exactly how it went, to us to decide the importance of those things. But ultimately, what are we looking at? Worst case scenario? Is it this? He makes some good points. Why I want to read it. Indeed, what is happening indicates a sharp intensification of the American intelligence services in the foreign policy arena. They are raising their agents and sleepers all over the world. Venezuela President Nicolas Maduro, for example, disclosed the data of the Venezuelan special services. They point out that the CIA operatives and their agents are behind the attempted assassination of Donald Trump, as well as provoking unrest in Caracas. In the case of Haniyeh's murder, the CIA is actively trying to lead the trail away from itself. They make a controlled injection into the information field about how this crime was allegedly organized. They say that a spy virus was embedded in Haniyeh's smartphone, which was able to track his location and point a missile at him. It's like in the Hollywood movies. However, only an idiot would think that Haniyeh was using an unprotected smartphone thereby becoming an easy target. The CIA's agent in Tehran were involved in the murder of Haniyeh, who carried out all the necessary preparations. Despite digitalization, and other smart things, the basis of intelligence remains human intelligence, that is, working with people. The CIA does dirty work all over the world and finds itself, despite careful attempts to confuse the tracks. All these should cause great concern to the international community. In fact, the CIA behaves like a robber who has been discovered and now in a hurry burns everything in his path. Currently, the situation in the Middle East is tense to the limit. Incoming information from Western media can be rejected at the root. Why should the New York Times journalists be believed when they write the following? They have already been informed by 3 sources that Iran's supreme leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei allegedly ordered a direct strike against Israel in response to the assassination of Haniyeh. Once again, the United States controls the global information space and skillfully pushes the meanings that they need. It should be noted that Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who spoke yesterday, did not take responsibility for what happened in Tehran. At the same time, the U.S. media is wringing that it was the Israeli authorities who did this, allegedly without information informing Washington. All this looks ridiculous because Tel Aviv always coordinates all its key steps with the United States authorities. Tel Aviv needs to think about whether the financial assistance that comes from the United States is worth the loss of sovereign policy, or whether Washington is not behind all those tragic events that have jeopardized the safety of Israeli residents. The CIA is trying to bring different sides together who may not be friends, but clearly do not want war. Unlike the U.S. authorities who are not fed bread, but let's celebrate the Maidan and military conflicts around the world. So in this contention, asking, is this contention applicable to the Trump assassination attempt as a possibility? But just remember, they missed. In Occam's view, they didn't have to kill Trump if they could impress him to unequivocally attack Iran. Then we heard Netanyahu visit Trump, and that's what came out. He wants to, conditioned on his death or assassination, he wants Iran obliterated. That was pretty quick work. Then I run across an interesting, recent, maybe within the month or so, broadcast link. You may want to listen to it. It's called Mossad's Little Helpers. Very interesting insights. It goes pretty quick. They're showing you all the some of the workings of some people that have done the study, somebody in the United States who is a professor on the receiving end of these types of propagandized issues, these types of attacks that I think are interesting for us to get a bearing on, because without hearing it, we're surprised. It's like the reason I hear why they don't want to talk about their torture techniques are so explicitly so. They don't want to give your mind the ability to wrap around what might be happening because it desensitizes you to the problem and it doesn't work so well. Same thing here. If you start learning what is being done blind to us or covertly, right in front of us, right around us, we may be able to start seeing some of the clues when we're watching things going on. When certain things start to happen in let's say, a sequence, we can start putting two and two together for ourselves and realize there's a player behind there and maybe even see what they're after. And partly that's to see that, but also to not incriminate, if you will, be brought into incriminating innocent people, which is what this is about, which ultimately, when they pull the trigger, they're killing somebody. Well, unless it might be Trump, right? But that's, again, potential of possibility. But interesting dynamic, Mossad's Little Helpers, neat little program. It's only like a half an hour. You might want to get a little bit of an earful on this one and then tie it back to what we're watching. And see if there's not things going on there, whether it's Mossad or the CIA. There's an intimate relationship. There's nothing to say that they're not actually being quiet to do that, and they're all working together either, right? I mean, everything's about anything possible. But look at what they're after, and look what they want to do. Look at the perception they want to make. Look at the trouble they want to cause in order to make that next step happen. And a few days before the Haniyeh assassination, to show you how intense it's starting to get, but also that it's a lot of talk, Erdogan says Turkey might enter Israel to help Palestinians. I can interject right here. The ICJ said we don't need to wait, but here we are. We're going to now talk about it. But still, we don't know what Turkey would be doing, and they're a formidable army, so we would watch this very carefully. President Tayyip Erdogan said on Sunday that the Turkey might enter Israel as it had done in the past in Libya and Nagorno-Karabakh, though he did not spell out what sort of intervention he was suggesting. Erdogan, who has been a fierce critic of Israel's offensive in Gaza, started discussing that war during his speech, praising his country's defense industry. Quote, "We must be very strong so that Israel can't do these ridiculous things to Palestine. Just like we entered Karabakh, just like we entered Libya, we might do similar to them," Erdogan told a meeting of the ruling AK party in his hometown of Riz. "There is no reason why we cannot do this. We must be strong and so that we can take these steps," Erdogan added in a television address. So now he's preparing his people as well. As I said, the leader needs to get consent of the people. As I said, we watched Putin masterfully do. And pretty quickly, too, actually. And they're actually, if you looked at what Russia did, they focused in on their culture, the honor, the regard they have for their culture, and the honor that they bestow upon their heritage and other things to make a distinction that they had a thing to fight for. And people were up with it, and I don't want to default that at all. I'm not judging it. I'm saying that's what you do. You find something that people will stand up and protect. And we've sort of got that kind of messed up a bit here in the United States. But we'll see. And as they get us divided, that's the part of the problem. And the U.S. responds here, as I said before, with these things coming down. And days before Erdogan saying he might come in, U.S. responds to protect the illegal belligerent occupying Zionista genocide by, as I just mentioned, sending the warships and troops over there now. We ask the question, then, which American warships are en route to Lebanon? The United States is said to have sent warships to the Mediterranean, according to reports by several media outlets, and the information obtained by L'Orient, La Jour's political columnist. Their deployment follows the assassination of Hamas' political leader, Ismail Haniyeh, in Tehran, and an Israeli strike that targeted a high-ranking Hezbollah official in Beirut's southern suburb in Lebanon on Tuesday night, raising fears of a significant escalation in the conflict between Hezbollah and Israel. According to the British Daily, The Telegraph, the three ships are en route to Lebanon, the USS Wasp, USS New York, and USS Oak Hill. These vessels reportedly have 2,200 soldiers, 2,200 soldiers on board, and possess the means to conduct evacuations. Lebanese General Wahbe Khatija said these ships are here to contain the situation and not to engage in military actions because no one wants an extended war. With the World Monitor reporting 4,000 Marines and sailors, including an amphibious assault teams. Now, here we go again. Evacuation is not containment of potential war. And no one wants an extended war, they say, but no one stops international law violating Israel from widening the war. Everyone, wink and nod, says no one wants wars expanded. So the amphibious assault team is not a containment team. It's not an evacuation team. It says assault. What we have here is the Zionist Federation movement pretending to be a legitimate state that wants an expanded war for the U.S. government to provide the means to execute. Because without the U.S. government, the Zionist Federation movement is not so chosen nor so supreme to pull it off all by itself. But the article asks here, what do we know about these three American fleet ships? Well, one is, you can get the link to read about the rest, but the USS Wasp is that amphibious assault ship used to conduct an assault from sea to land whose primary mission is to support American Marines in combat, but also to provide disaster relief and medical support to those in need, according to the website of the U.S. Army 2nd Fleet. So the WASP isn't merely a hospital ship here with no military capacity. Its primary mission is to support a Marines in combat, of which at least 2,200 soldiers in amphibious assault teams are en route. And this is the point I made. The point I haven't heard here, that the Lebanese are in need, that they may be helping. I don't know what that need the Lebanese have said this assault team will be doing, where that says that they provide disaster relief and medical support. No one's mentioned it. That people needing to leave can't make normal arrangements to do so that don't require an amphibious assault team. And so, again, looking through some of this, it's not looking so good. And I guess I'm concerned now, the technology anymore, since particularly the missile technologies that have been coming out, make this so much more dangerous. You think that all this military capacity would back everybody off. But no, we got another agenda, and that's what I want us to look through. There's a different agenda running. They don't care that our soldiers die. They don't care that Lebanese die. They don't care about Hezbollah. In a way, they don't care about the Jewish soldiers either. This is about a function. But as we watch the ducks get lined up in a row, one step after the other, as I mentioned, looking at the Trump assassination attempt through Occam's view, here they are. The war pigs are lining up as well. After the assassination of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran on Tuesday, Iran promised a harsh punishment for Israel. Let me offer here, it was being pointed out, I think they said a harsh punishment, but they hadn't used that there would be blood drawn. This time they're saying there's going to be blood drawn. And so they're also saying people will be amazed at what the response is going to be when they watch it and they see it. We're also hearing reports that hypersonic missiles are being moved in Iran toward the westward to get them closer over to where Israel is. So the honor that's going to be respected here by Iran may be really formidable. We may see something that we may not have ever seen, or Israel may have ever considered, or even the United States, as it's losing to the Yemenis over there as the shipping gets destroyed. That whole thing got destroyed. Not destroyed as far as the United States ships, the function of those ships did not work. The world is coming to a point where there's technology that says we're not going to back down anymore. As I told you when I saw Russia doing what it was doing, enough is enough, and they're now powerful enough to stop it. Harsh treatment by Israel. On Wednesday, the U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin declared that the United States was ready to defend Israel in the event of an attack by Iran. United States Lindsey Graham, Republican of South Carolina, folks in South Carolina, I know what you're doing with him in office. But anyway, introduced legislation right before the Congress recess in August that would authorize President Joe Biden to use military force against Iran if he determines that the Iran has the capabilities to threaten the national security interests of the United States. Quote, the president is authorized to use all necessary and appropriate force against the Islamic Republic of Iran if the president determines that the Islamic Republic of Iran, one, is in the process of possessing a nuclear weapon that threatens the national security interests of the United States, or two, possesses uranium-enriched to weapons-grade level, possesses a nuclear warhead, or possesses a delivery vehicle capable of carrying a nuclear warhead that threatens the national security interests of the United States. While the bill specifies that it is limited to Iran's nuclear program, it is broad enough to potentially authorize Biden to strike Iran as soon as the bill passes. And why is that? How can it be perceived to allow Biden or Kamala Harris or the assassination impressionable Trump to use it immediately? It's in the word determines. If the president determines. How is that? There's no guideline on how the president determines. It could be faulty intel, duplicitous suggestions of a foreign agent, the proofs created by the national security interests being spoken of and not stated in the legislation, which is actually speaking to the Zionist Federation movement. They offer information compromising the condition from and through the compromised legislators. Anything that can be used on how this president determines, or a president determines. It's written here in the article, while Iran is not believed to possess a nuclear warhead, it already has an arsenal of missiles that would be capable of carrying a nuclear warhead if Iran were to obtain one. Biden seemingly would be authorized by the bill to strike Iran if he determines that to be a threat. So, no guidelines. So let us toss into this word salad another arbitrary and capricious reason. We said it the same day. Graham also introduced a bill that would affirm an escalation by Hezbollah, what will seem to be as an escalation by Iran. So we're guilty by association, I suppose, in this country, are we? Well, not really, but now we're going to make it law. Again, we twist and turn everything we need, line everything up, to give anybody who has the authority to make a decision the plausible authority. So if the president determines that to be a threat to what? So that is the other thing, the fraudulent omission of defining what the national interests is. And I say is, not are. It can't be the mere possession of nuclear weapons. Lots of nations have those now, right? It won't be written into the legislation for more comprehensive threats by the United States either. That's why that's not done. But Graham explains on X Twitter, of all of official places now we get to go read it, what he won't put in that legislation. On Thursday, Graham posted on X Twitter that it is long past time to start talking about offense when it comes to Iranian threats against Israel, the United States, and the world. There, the national interest. Iran does not pose a threat to the world, that the world wouldn't respond if Iran tried anything. So what's left? The national interest is the Zionist Federation political movement posing as a legitimate government under the color of the name State of Israel. And Graham explains the duplicitous omission national interest means coming to the aid of an illegal belligerent occupier committing genocide, other war crimes, and committing broad violations of international law. That any appropriations here, if you look at this, is contrary to existing U.S. law coming out of the gate. We're not supposed to be violating the use of the money. Can't violate international law. We can't violate our own law. And all of this despite Iran, in face of the undisclosed here threat the U.S. national interest poses, has the right to protect itself by whatever means, which such proposed legislation proves the need to do so. And yet we're going to see these compromised Congress critters saying, spend the money, send the boys. And I'm not so sure that's what we really want to do, but who am I? I'm just a guy behind the woodshed. This is BTWRLM 588. For those of you coming in after the hour, moving on here, to go to the blogcaster, get the links. So moving through this, again, ongoing, something that's not normally arranged here is we want a normal arrangement in the international setup, or international norms. They're being violated. We're watching that reflection inside. Something not normally arranged is a palace coup. Obama and Kamala threatened to invoke the 25th Amendment on Biden before he dropped out. Now, I've talked a little bit about this. This story now comes from Seymour Hersh, more specific to that condition. And I want to discuss it a little bit through Seymour Hersh's discussion or someone reviewing that to show what's happening inside the gates. Who's inside that's driving this thing? How they're driving it, possibly, what they're doing, and who's actually the players? And we see the false front government that's going on as we read through this, and other lots of things through this story. A new Substack out by Seymour Hersh indicates that former President Barack Obama, the VP Kamala, means Harris, mean Harris, Kamala, now presumptive Democrat nominee for president, which I think she just got told that she has enough votes, so she's going to be the nominee for president. He threatened sitting President Joe Biden with a potential invocation of the 25th Amendment if he didn't drop out of the president's race and cede the spot to the VP, mean Harris. This would mean that not only did they force Biden out of the race, but that the Democrats know full well that Biden isn't fit to serve out the rest of his term, but are comfortable letting him continue as a figurehead if it serves their efforts to retain power for the party. It looks like Obama chose Kamala as his new figurehead. It means the Democrats now know Biden isn't fit to serve the rest of his term. However, they're fine with him completing this term so they can continue the agenda. And this is the thing. It's about these agendas. Biden engaged in a debate with former President GOP nominee for President Donald Trump on June 27th. It was so bad that almost instantly Democratic leaders and pundits were looking for a way to get Biden off the ticket. They could see that there was a very little chance that Biden, in his diminished state, could beat Trump at the ballot box. And I find that statement interesting given what we seems to be a big election fraud where they had commandeered votes by all types of means. That aside, the party elite were aghast and worked hard both in public and private to oust Biden. While much of that played out in leaked rumor speculation, it turns out, per Hirsch, that there was a going on behind the scenes was a kind of coup complete with threats from Obama and Kamala team. By Saturday, July 20th, Hirsch writes, former President Barack Obama was deeply involved and there was talk that he would place a call to Biden, and it was not clear whether Biden had been examined or just what happened to him in Las Vegas. The big, quote, the big three, the official said, referring to the former House Speaker Nancy Pelosi, Senate Majority Leader Charles Schumer, and House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, continued to be directly involved. On Sunday morning, the official told me, with the approval of Pelosi and Schumer, Obama called Biden after breakfast and said, here's the deal. We have Kamala's approval to invoke the 25th. The amendment provides that when the president is determined by the vice president and others to be unfit to carry out the powers of the duties of the office, the vice president shall assume their duties. It was clear at this point, the official said, per Hirsch, that she would get the nod, that is, the support to run for the presidency in the November election. But Obama also made it clear, the official said, that he was not going to immediately endorse her because the group had decided that her work as a prosecutor would help her deal with Trump in a debate. On July 26th, the Obamas, both Barack and Michelle, did endorse Harris. The phone call during which they offered her their backing was filmed. The call on the speaker, while Harris held the phone to her ear, a mic could be seen pinned to her blazer. Quote, the official, who has decades of experience in fundraising, told me that Obama emerged as a strong man throughout the negotiations. He had any agenda he wanted to see it through to the end, and he wanted to have control over who would be elected. According to Hirsch, deep-pocketed Democrat donors forced the resignation. If Hirsch is right, however, it becomes apparent that Biden did not step down selflessly, but was forced out lest he lose his presidency altogether. And it becomes further obvious that Harris was installed by the top party brass and not, as they'd like Americans to believe, by grassroots. To date, Harris has not received a single vote. Now, she's got the party vote, but not votes from people or electors. And as I said last week, they don't need grassroots support. You can see it now, but we also understand what these are. These political parties are private, just like a private corporation. Now, I don't think that Obama is part of the Biden's cabinet here when Obama says we. And I don't think he was speaking French. So how much thinner does this veil have to get for people to see the naked, ugly truth of how this usurped government is run? With Biden out in 2024, the race, what's the deep state's next move here? The deeply unlikable Kamala Harris has been tapped to get the Democratic nomination. Can her victory be ensured behind the scenes? Harris continues to delude herself that she is presidential material. The past 4 years have clearly and painfully proven she is not. Not only did the vice president demonstrate her inability to perform simple functions, questions about her office management skills have repeatedly raised by her staff. Her staff, many of which are said to have quit working for her in disgust. The only way Kamala Harris, Mean Harris, can win the next election is through voter fraud, it seems to me. The Democrats have ascertained beforehand that mail-in ballots, together with millions of migrant work voters, is enough. And so it's not over yet. The usurpation of this place continues. We're watching the election process, I should say, completely exposed for the corruption that it is and has been. It's just now coming out to more people. I don't know that that's going to be enough, but we'll see. I'm hoping, again, I'm not too thrilled after watching the great Comey swindle and pass muster to 80% of the population. That's what we're looking at here on the voter side of it. No primaries, no alternatives, no security, anti-democracy reigns in the U.S. When the most democratic thing you can say about a two-party system is that one of the party's candidates received actual votes in the primary, and that's the party that accused of trying to end democracy, it's clear things have gone off the rails. As the Democratic Party argued in the court after being sued for alleging rigging the 2016 primaries in favor of Hillary Clinton, the two-party system is not technically part of the government and are free to run their primary processes however they like, even picking the candidates no one voted for, as they have done with Harris. This article follows after I said what I said last week, and I've said before. The Lords of Capital decided that he had to go, and in fact, they made it quite clear that he had to go because they said that not only would they stop contributing to his campaign, but they told the DNC, get rid of Joe Biden or don't expect any financial support for any Democrat candidate down ballot, argued political activist and the 2016 Green Party vice president nominee Ajumu Sibeko Baraka on Sputnik Political Misfits. This is a clear elite extortion. So it's easy to throw out these words, elite extortion. Ear-catching, isn't it? But is it extortion? Where extortion requires an unwarranted interference with a property under color of authority, what property is involved in this? In a private system, what is unwarranted? And being part of the private political labor union of sorts, where is the color of authority that isn't already agreed to in merely participating in the party? No, all what appears to be corruption is democracy, we now find. Quote, so this was, in fact, a coup by the donors, and we need to deal with that in that way because it exposes the true nature of this anti-democratic process we have in this country. So people who are committed to democracy, who would like to see something that approximates democracy, you can't continue to support these two anti-democratic parties. That's all an important point. But this is the woke mind virus at work being speaking here by this party. These processes aren't anti-democratic. They are, in fact, very democratic. And if you think being an independent or some other party somehow removes you, think again. You are just a marginalized private party and will likely be forced to choose the lesser of the two private evils perpetually. The article goes on to show an example that in 1992, Reform Party candidate Ross Perot led both Bill Clinton and George H.W. Bush in the polls after a strong debate performance. His campaign sank after he inexplicably dropped out in the summer before re-entering right before the election. Perot claimed that the GOP blackmailed him with doctored pictures of his daughter, but the accusations was never seriously investigated. The close call nevertheless scared the parties and two parties enough that they worked out to make sure it would never happen again. After the 92 campaign, the Commission of Presidential Debates, which touts its bipartisanship, listen very carefully how these words work against us. We think that they're good, but they're actually showing us the uniparty bipartisanship because it is staffed with Republicans and Democrats, increased the requirements of third-party candidates, increasing the national poll numbers a candidate needs to qualify from 5% to 15%. That Perot did not reach 15% until after he appeared on the debate stage with Clinton and Bush was not lost on the Perot campaign, which ran a series of ads in 1996 decrying the decision to no avail. In the 1990s and early 2000s, it was virtually impossible for a candidate to achieve those numbers without the assistance of media. Earlier this month, Sputnik reported that the U.S. Treasury halted funds awarded by the FEC, Federal Election Commission, to the campaign for Green Party candidate Jill Stein after the campaign hit required milestones. Quote, "This again is another reflection of the poverty of politics in this country," Baraka said, noting that the Democrats have been suing to get Green candidates off the ballot in many states. These are all examples of why the struggle has to be in this country to redefine what democracy is and has people prepared to struggle for them and not fall prey to this appeal to a lesser of two evils that is backwards, reactionary, anti-democratic, and profoundly dangerous, concluded Baraka. But I've explained how it isn't anti-democratic. It's fascism. It's public-private partnership. It's very democratic, like a private labor union is democratic. The private two-party corporate system partnering with government is fascism. Public-private partnerships is fascism, and you're already living in sustainability. You're already living sustainably. And your civil rights, these equal rights under law that you can read about it, that's 42 U.S.C. 1981, I mention all the time, says these privately partnered non-governmental organizations are under C, the protection against impairment. These organizations, the rights protected by this section, are protected against impairment by non-governmental discrimination and impairment under color of state law. The rights protected in A is the right enjoyed by white citizens and shall be subject to like punishment, pains, penalties, taxes, licenses and exactions of every kind and to no other is the right to enjoy extortion of our property, the property of ourselves, firstly, and those non-governmental organizations cannot remove that enjoyment underneath the law. But we've been living with this abomination the entire time. It's baked into our two-party controlled system. This country was to be controlled by law first and foremost, not private political or special interest, whom creates policy as law. And all of these questioning of our democracy and its reactionary dangerousness and injustice is geared to get everyone to transform this to an even more feckless, if there can be such a thing, a more feckless direct democracy, so-called, to bring everyone into a system of constant peonage, if we're not already there, no matter what party you believe you are in or not, none of that matters. None are left behind in democracy. Even those with property rights that ought to be left behind, because there is no property in human. You, man. Y-O-U, man. No property in you, man. Non-participation here in this system is a vote with the woke and ignorant masses of no political persuasion at that point. Your participation is the only thing that matters in this from them, even if one does not participate, sort of like now, but cyber gulag certified, because that non-participation is your choice to the benefit of the community, as you, man, agreed, consented to, kicking and screaming or not. The controls by the private political parties and the private bar association, we the people being reduced to choosing the lesser of two evils, have become a threat to this nation, its security, to the people, and need to be eliminated. Maybe for starters it's time to stop voting and challenge any official demand or enactments for violating the prohibition against forced associations by that non-participation or by implication or impairing the obligation to contract, the right not to enter into any or impairing those that exist, such as found in the savings clauses I continually talk about, because the fascist political system and the Bar Association, another private corporate union here, under the color of democracy of which, failed to keep that republic. It's destroying your property, your rights, your peaceful settlement, contracts, and other substantial things, making more perfect unionized war on the same. That democracy called civil war never ended. So the question would be, do you surrender or fight at this point? They've reduced you to a non-property. They will not recognize these things in you. when you get into a step further. There is none. That's why you have no property and like it. So do you surrender or fight? I mean, beyond the fist pump vote. I mean, come on. Will you defend yourself more than jacking your jaw? We'll see, won't we? These people got it all wired, and I don't think we quite got it figured out. But it's right here for us to be able to analyze and to see. And these, I don't have all the answers. I can just see the condition. And it's going to take, again, everyone has to be moving in the same direction. This is one of the weaknesses of having the right to alter and abolish. It wasn't any one of us. It has to be mutually agreed upon. And this palace coup we've been talking about by Obama didn't start until after that failed assassination attempt. And some people here, I want to talk about a little bit, some people are putting some effort into recreating a 4D model of that space, that place over in Butler. Very, very cool. And they're going to, this 4D model is, it creates it to look like a moving video game. So you see, you can move around in the space, virtually, if you will. And the position on this not only helps to look at, orient you to the, what went on to a much higher degree of exactness, it also allows for the ability to do better sound analysis than what I've seen around, which you can hear being done in this video, this link I'm going to send you, I'll give you if you want to look at it. And I want to thank Gary L. for turning me on to it. That worked out kind of neat here to see this because I was having a little bit of a problem. The video is called Multiple Shooters by John Cullen and Clay Martin. It was a Tommy's podcast on Rumble. You might be able to seek it out for yourself. But one of the problems I've been having in all this issue, notwithstanding the Occam's analysis, what did Occam say about this and what I've come up with, which is so far holding its own actually pretty well. One of the problems I was having was correlating the video that I was watching, with the actual positioning of everything. And these guys in this video, the crew that's working behind this, do that. They start laying this thing out. And you'll hear how it's very, very exacting down to the bleachers. The guy got a schematic on its construction and laid it all out into a model. Pretty cool. So these modelings here help us answer questions that I've had but couldn't determine from what I was seeing when you're just looking at all bits and pieces of video. In particular, when I first saw the video, just Trump, that's my only, it was a little bitty screen, I could barely make it out. I noticed the back row of the bleachers. There was something going on there, but it was so small I couldn't tell. That's been a question in my mind the whole time. What was going on in the back bleacher, back of the black bleachers right behind Trump? And because I didn't understand the orientation, I couldn't quite figure it out. But these guys make it so you can understand it. I understand now what I was looking at. And I have to agree with John Cullen as to his assessment, which indicates another shooter in a different place than anywhere that we've heard. But that ghost shooter is there for an interesting reason, which supports more of what John Cullen's theory is about this. Now, the way they're putting this together, it's quite amazing, actually. Almost being inside the space and being able to look around and take lines. All this work is, they're offering a lot to chew on in this, so I would say listen to the video, but understand there's going to be a whole lot to put together. And I, because when you start to think more clearly and not to judge it in dismissal, I think he offers a ton that needs to be considered. I think there's a number of problems with the assessment. If you look at this, for instance, when you're watching the video, sometimes he'll show how things lined up. They don't actually line up. Now, that may work out as they perfect the model a little bit more, but you got to be very careful not to just jump in. It sounds plausible. Let's just jump on and take it as right. If things don't line up, I ask you, keep that in mind that they don't line up and reconsider what might be happening or factor that in. That these things need to be confirmed when you're watching this. He admits that it's just an idea. It's what he's put together, and he's open for people to help. So he's asking for those that have expertise in sniper work and in modeling this, maybe to get in touch with him. But his work, these guys' work, that they got, all these people working together, they're offering a quantum jump into getting a better sense of what went on and when. And I think it's important to understand these things. This is like understanding what torture you're going to face. It's like understanding a situation before you get into it. Your mind's better prepared. You can be a better observer. You can start to pick these things out. You can start cutting through the CIA and all its misinformation. Your mind starts to understand what to start looking for, I think, is probably the good reason why you look at this and what these folks are doing to bring it to us. But another problem I have, just to keep it out there, I don't want to dismiss this. This is a very powerful work, but be aware. One of my problems is that when you listen to all these supposed things that are going on, I think someone's going to have to sit down with like chronology and really get it detailed. The whens and those need to be detailed better by whom, with what they did it with, and how. I think those need to be slowed down in this analysis. I think that needs to be done. And I still don't agree that any U.S. countersniper took out the Patsy, which they agree Crooks was a Patsy now, as Occam would have said for this. So, but I don't agree that it was a U.S. countersniper. I have a real problem with the participation part of this. But the video evidence of the kill shot for Crooks doesn't appear to be able to even come from the direction of the U.S. snipers. Again, an orientation has to be made. But from my view, with the video that was available, the round comes from a different direction from where the U.S. sniper team that was supposedly on the building that had a clear shot around the trees. The camera's coming is inside the tree line. And the bullet comes from the right from the trees themselves. It cannot be a clear shot. So that's another thing to look out for. And I'm mentioning these things. So when you're looking at it, think about that. Think if there's some details that are kind of jumbled up a little bit that need to be reorganized to get a better idea. It may not disprove it. It actually may be better to understand once you straighten it up. And we pay attention here because he says that here's the kill shot for Crooks and the U.S. snipers did it, but he's talking about a subsonic round, and this is where his contribution doing the audio analysis is brilliant. There's a ton more ammunition rounds going off than we would have ever thought, given what he's shown us is true, that there's subsonic ammunition being fired. Not the supersonic, if you will, the big, fast, you know, 223s, backed up ARs, the Winchester rounds. And that's the thing. Keep track of what he's saying is being fired by whom when you're watching. If a subsonic round is coming to kill Crooks, it couldn't be, by his definition, the U.S. countersnipers who used something like a Winchester round, if I remember that correctly. That subsonic round also shouldn't be able to strike Crooks in the head, the one you see in the video, which the one that comes through the video that they show right near the building of the other sniper, the second shooter. That round coming through should be subsonic, but it doesn't hit Crooks in the head the way he gets hit in the head. So though I hear what Colin is saying, that's the kill shot, it's, to my perspective, it's not actually correct. It's a subsonic round that didn't come from the U.S. counter snipers. Had to come from some other direction, actually. And this is all what my theory was, and it actually builds into something that Cullen was saying in a different way. So keep track of these subsonic rounds and who's shooting them and how. Think about how that could happen. So the way they strike Crooks can't come from anywhere from the tree line back to the back. It has to come from the other side, which they start to discuss. So the round that hit Crooks went in the left temple, down across his head, and out below his jaw on the right-hand side. And it's a rather steep angle. So in your mind, think about steep, and you start getting an idea where this thing had to come from, or somewhere close to that. So if Crooks didn't tilt his head almost exactly opposite what Trump did when you saw Trump move his head, if Crooks didn't do it the exact opposite movement right at the moment of impact, that bullet could not have come from the trees. It couldn't have come from the rooftops across the field. None of that. It had to come from the water tower. So there's more to compile and figure out about this. But I think they're onto a good path for doing that. He also says his sonics analysis shows there was someone in the trees behind the water tower, possibly. That could have been a surrogate for the water tower shot. because it can't come from the front. The shot has to come from behind the kid. So, look at this. I'm taking a lot of time here to discuss this. I think this is a big work that needs to be done, and I think it becomes instructive on what we, the people, are up against. And I think we need to get a better assessment of that. And looking at the thinking this through, I would also be careful of whom he attributes, again, the sonic and subsonic. I think he's confusing the U.S. snipers at times with the assassins, the shooters. And that will have to be borne out in a better analysis. Like I said, it was going fast, a lot to chew on. But if anybody's interested, get this link, find it anywhere. You don't have to get to the broadcaster if you know where it's at. Find what it's at if you're interested. Look at what they're doing. Look at what can happen in this future thing. It's very cool what could be brought together by a bunch of private people where you find out your government's not really holding it up. So I guess I'll stop there. I wanted to say some things about it. It's kind of exciting to watch the amount of work that's going into it and what it can bring out. And allows you to slow down and watch things and analyze things much, much better. It certainly cannot be viewed more as simplistic as we've been seeing. So, but I will say, even that so, my Occam's analysis, adding the water tower last week to include multiple shooter scenarios here, is not disproven, is what is interesting. And in fact, that becomes a stated potential as to what went on. So, this get back to the beginning, taking what we would consider Occam's razor's approach, has it been such a bad thing to get through, to cut through the noise, to stop letting, let's say, the CIA misinformation come in, and even what we do to ourselves, to cut right through this thing, to start getting an idea of what's going on. And watch, as I was suggesting, this is a bigger deal. This is about going to war, possibly. This is one of those other multifaceted things that brings societies to where they are willing to go to war and go die for things that are all a setup and a fraud. Someone's agenda. Someone's fraudulent agenda on top of that. So, neat video. I was pretty thrilled to watch it. Thank you again, Gary, about sending it to me. I was lost in the orientation. Once I got that, now my mind was freed up a bit to start agreeing. I could start saying, oh, yeah, that goes, that has to, oh, that answers why I saw that. Now let's put it over there. And even so, you go to the point, okay, well, he never placed the shooter. Well, then what about this one over here? And then you still get to get questions. You still have things to answer, but the basics are answered in what they're doing. We can start understanding how someone goes to plan how you assassinate someone. And now we're not talking about just the execution of someone, just the execution of a multi-layered plan to push through what they need while everyone's confounded by all this other things going on. Because the interesting thing that Colin comes up with is this shooter in the trees may just be someone he's taking out evidence and he's keeping evidence, the sniper team down. So they can pull another layered shots off. The kid's a patsy. He's not going to get a shot off, as I told you. He went there to die. He didn't know that, but that's where he went. But there's layers of attack underneath that on top of it. And so it's very interesting to watch how this may have played out and how it was planned, but someone had to make that plan. Who? Our minds may have to go a little bit further, but the culprits get less and less. I mean, it's going to be so. It's not just some kid that took care of old folks, that's for sure. I think there's a suggestion that we watch who they talk about at the end of the video, who was funding this. It could have been the Democrats and the political party and Obama and the Clinton and who knows what's going on. And although you watch the donations that are going on, the fronts that they use to launder money through to pay for all this stuff. We have a bigger thing as a society to understand, I think is why I got a little bit excited to see people putting so much time in actually pulling out some information that may be extrapolated out to other places. And if you took issue relative to the Trump assassination attempt with the apparent incompetence of the Secret Service and DEI appearing the hires in this Lincolnized Civil War and terror era, it's not just the Secret Service. So there's more comprehensive an understanding that starts to come with all of this. Leaked emails reveal Civil War at CIA regime change cutout. An embarrassing interview has exposed rifts at the National Endowment of Democracy. The last paragraph first. NED, was founded in 1983 at the behest of the CIA, which proposed the creation of such an organization to then-President Ronald Reagan. NED founder Alan Weinstein admitted to the Washington Post in 1991, quote, "What we do today was done covertly 25 years ago by the CIA," close quote. Internal rancor has gripped the U.S. NGO National Endowment of Democracy, NED, a CIA cutout responsible for fermenting political discontent in countries regarded as adversaries by Washington. It's perhaps best known for helping to foment the 2014 Maidan coup in Ukraine, a country that its founder, Carl Gershman, labeled the biggest prize. The debacle has resulted in two senior officials being fired and a civil war erupting between older neoconservatives and younger management, which the former accuses of being too woke, according to documents obtained by the Gray Zone. The scandal was sparked after the newly appointed NED vice president for communications broke ranks by engaging with journalists the organization had previously shunned. Leslie Un took exception to the Gray Zone's portrayal of the organization as CIA proxy and initiated a call with outlets Max Blumenthal and Alex Rubenstein, which it published in May of 2023. During the call, Un failed to provide any assurance of any statutory separation between NED and the CIA. Quote, "I don't know if it's in the statute. I don't know if it's, I don't know. I'm going to sound like an idiot. I don't mean to sound like an idiot," she told the reporters. On Tuesday, the Gray Zone published several leaked emails between Michael Allen, former editor of the NED's Democracy Digest blog, and the endowment's founder, President Carl Gershman, revealing that the fallout from the call's publication may have cost Aoun and Allen their jobs. Gray Zone didn't reveal where it had obtained the correspondence. Quote, "Amateur hour. Hugely embarrassing," Allen emailed Gershman and NED VP for Government Relations David Lowe a day after the recording was posted on YouTube, said, "I specifically counseled against her talking to these people." Lowe described Un's performance as breathtakingly ignorant and too painful to listen to. Both he and Gershman, who retired in 2021, appeared to disparage the new NED president, Damon Wilson, as a veteran of NATO's Atlantic Council adjunct, for hiring her. Gershman described the call as a disastrous screw-up and described Aoun as obviously clueless, a moron, and clueless wonder whose hiring was an egregious error, reflecting Wilson's alleged focus on the media and image. In messages to Gershman and Lowe, Allen blamed NED Communications Director Christine Bednarz, who reportedly encouraged Aoun to talk to the Gray Zone. Allen also turned his fire on Bednarz for instituting mandatory, quote, diversity, equity, and inclusion training and berating him about his white male privilege. In one email, Allen complained about the DEI training agenda, including microaggressions and the ideological, not historical, 1619 project, noting that Bednarz had berated him for not using pronouns on his business cards and email signature. This is what's important now, folks. At one point, Gershman asked if Bednarz harbored some kind of personal resentment for her Israeli ex-husband, or if she was just a woke flake, to which Ellen replied the latter, combined with a certain megalomania and defensive resentment over Gray Zone fiasco. Allen was eventually fired on December 12th in an email, and Gershman and Lowe in February. He claimed his move was in part due to marginalization prompted by the Gray Zone affair, arguably the biggest PR fiasco in NED's history. Aoun was fired at some point as well and paid a substantial settlement for sex discrimination, according to the documents obtained by Gray Zone, her online biographies make no mention of her work at NED. And such is the state of democracy in the Republic, we the people didn't keep. And this is an impressive admission by Trump. And I just wanted to, when he said, like, why did he say all these things if he's simply pandering for votes? He didn't need to say any of what he says at the crypto conference in Nashville, Tennessee. But Trump can't help himself. Crypto capital of the planet, delving into U.S. stash of digital coins. Former U.S. President and current Republican president nominee Trump had pledged to make America the crypto capital of the planet and create a Bitcoin BTC strategic reserve using the currency that the government currently holds. Does anyone else hear global reserve currency surrogate for the U.S. dollar in the Siberian gulag? And remember, a pledge by a candidate doesn't mean anything, or that a pledge, if fulfilled, will turn out as pledged. For a Bitcoin strategic reserve? Think of the military word here, strategic. What is that? What's he talking about? Well, right now, the White House has more than 180,000 BTC worth approximately $12.3 billion, something that makes the U.S. government the world's largest owner of the digital coins, according to the latest data from Arkham, a crypto intelligence platform. The current U.S. authorities also hold other cryptocurrencies, such as the 50,000 Ether, worth $166.7 million, as well as the major stable coins, like 121 million USDC worth 121.7 million and 40,000 BNB valued at 23.2 million. Additionally, the government is in possession of 750,000 WBTC worth $50 million, 19 million AUSDC worth 18 million and 13 million BUSDC valued at 13.6 million, Arkham data showed. Now, wasn't all this stolen from people through asset forfeiture, that they have it? So the reserve currency is going to be based upon electrons stolen from someone by calling them a criminal. That seems no different than what the U.S. does to the Russians when they use government, when the U.S. government wants your stuff there as well. I mean, it's just like a steady plan of theft. You don't think that they got a hold of those funds they confiscated that can't do it to you when they make it a reserve currency? When you violate the Siberian gulag obligations? And Trump is committed to set you up just like he did the great Comey swindle? Trump has meanwhile made it clear during the recent speech at a Bitcoin conference at Nashville, Tennessee, that he wanted a cryptocurrency mined, minted, and made in the U.S. In the U.S. Think jurisdictionally here. He also sought to contrast his support of cryptocurrency to the Biden's administration efforts to regulate the industry, telling the crowd that the federal government was blocking your way. So this neo-crypto messiah is going to make easier to enter that cyber gulag, it sounds to me. Do you think made in the U.S. means made privately by you as your private property? Do you really think that's what he means there? And I'd like to remind you, my listener, Nashville, Tennessee is a sustainability hub in the East. Why the sustainability coincidences? Why do we even see it like this? Does anyone else notice the continuing correlations as they pull this together? How coincidental can you get? According to Trump, they took it away from you. So as I take the steps to transform the vast wealth into a permanent national asset, to benefit all Americans today, I repeat my promise to commute the sentence of Ross Ulbricht, the founder of the Silk Road website. So, Ulbricht has released votes by buying is made, but the government keeps his Bitcoin, don't it? So, that's a promise that he gets released for buying your vote. But in the wild, they actually haven't taken anything away yet, have they? Saying that they've taken something primes the mind to want the object is what's going on here. And the problem is, will the object of your desire match the objective of the they to keep you from yours, while the they have you feeling nothing more than feelings. Whoa, feeling you have control. And the entertaining Trumpomaniac intends that vast wealth of electrons to be a permanent, I said permanent, he said permanent national asset to benefit all Americans. He didn't say your asset. See, the military is a national asset as well, which benefits all Americans, so-called. So try to control that. Listen to apply what he's saying. Or how about those military and other strategic facilities or U.S. highways, such as those created in 1956 in the Highways Act, the National Interstate and Defense Highways Act of 1956, in amendment, the supplement to the Federal Aid Road Act, approved July 11, 1916, to authorize appropriations to continue the construction of highways, to amend the Internal Revenue Code of 1954, to provide additional revenue for the taxes on motor fuel tires and trucks and buses and other purposes? Are you free to use those, or is it a privilege you are gave by the plantation owner? See, these strategic highways certainly don't benefit small-town America, where the people live, but they bypass them. Isn't it that you do have to get registered and regulated and pay fees and taxes, extortions to do that, to use those? And if you don't, isn't it true, if you think you have a right to drive or a right to travel, you will enjoy an equal right to date with the federal highwayman, a revenue, or a local cop and local banks, or I mean courts? Follow the fiat, folks. And don't miss the for other purposes part of that Highway Act. It's also controlled by executive order. And people ignorant of the fact that when the military needs to use those strategic national asset highways for national security purposes, you can't. Yeah, crypto is headed that direction. Listen to what Trump's saying. The crypto national strategic reserve is not your reserve. Your planet-wide global token citizenship will have the obligation to national security as a strategic economic asset managed by plunder as well as extortion, i.e. taxes, soon to be the global taxes in the national interest on your debt and full faith and credit, a loan that can never be extinguished by an ignorant people, partly because you're participating. And Trump is declaring the conversion of all crypto to become a national asset, not your asset. What Trump is offering is, hi, I'm from the government. I'm here to help you. You crypto folks better not let Trump and his technopaths touch crypto. That's not going to happen, but I'm telling you that's what you need to do. But that they already have touched it, haven't they? And as I said, crypto should never allow. Don't let any government get its grubby paws on crypto if you want to use it free of government control. You should also tell Trump and the test that the U.S. government isn't supposed to steal the crypto under guise of the corrupt asset forfeiture. But if it did, it is to sell it in the open market ASAP to benefit all Americans, if that's what he wanted to do. But you got to keep the government in its box, but Trump doesn't actually intend that. He intends to enslave all Americans to the global financial system of the planet, as I discussed it, I've pointed out to you, you can read it for yourself, as a strategic reserve in the crypto capital planet of the world. As went the Big Apple, so goes crypto. And remember, even if Trump be true, he's only in office 4 years, and then it's gone. He's gone, and your crypto's gone. The ironic vice grip the people are in, Trump is the better thing going anyway. This is the problem. He's got himself in a good position. We can't continue underneath the alternative. But the people are stuck in the jaws of monetary and fiscal defeat, and Trump is the setup man in the Siberian takedown scheme. So trust the plan. Trump harder. And while are all the countries implementing CBDCs anyway, if that's not where it's going? What's in your wallet, folks? No. What's in your wallet? And you'll never know until you look and see that it's gone in Schrodinger's quantum Siberian gulag, because that's what's in your quantum wallet will become what wallet? But if we want to get an eyeball, we can just see the story. Russia brings crypto in, and as I said long ago, highly trackable, traceable, and regulated, that we can read, and I'll just mention it. You can go find the link, you go read it for yourself. Russia upper house approves crypto law. And it's trackable, traceable, regulable, by permission, only by government, and they will say what's going to happen. There's your future with it. Just like I was saying, it's all been written. Hope something I said to get you oriented correctly, like maybe that video might, modeling video, get ourselves oriented to reality, look through the noise, make a better decision, don't engage, stay off the tracks, make sure we're at least facing the right direction if there's a train on time, stay aside, far enough away that we don't get ourselves hurt. And when they try to come after you and you're that far away, then you can take them behind the woodshed, likely with, hopefully with the black and white, with a nice solid foundation underneath you, and expose them for the extortionists that they are, that they had no right to put on you, because you weren't in their jurisdiction, and you knew all about that. You knew what the plans were. You knew the evil of the world, how it's coming on us. And you learned not to yoke with that at all. This has been episode BTWRLM 588. And I'll be with you, tech diffs or nature willing. And I'll be with you next week, tech diffs or nature willing.
Echoes call, the hour is near. Behind the woodshed, the truth you'll hear. Every Sunday, the clock strikes three. Hal's voice rolls like thunder, piercing free. Pull up a chair, lean in close, lessons to learn. Dose by dose, behind the woodshed, no stone unturned. Next week, heed the call, behind the woodshed standing tall.